Pergam nosmata.
Yes, the accent is on the antepenultimate syllable.
Pergam nosmata is a big, long Greek word that impresses people when you drop it at cocktail parties and in dinner table conversation. Pergam nosmata are, or is, I haven't figured out whether it's singular or plural yet, a collection of elementary exercises used by the ancients to train orators. According to Quintilian, the Roman theorist and teacher and practitioner of rhetoric, these exercises were assigned by the grammaticus, the teacher in early literature and grammar, and after completing the first several of the exercises of the Pergam Nosmata, and there are what has come down to us from the late antique period, 14 such exercises. But after completing the first several of them, then he would move on to be trained by a rhetor, the rhetoric instructor. And in recent centuries, attention to Pergam Nosmata has waned. And this makes this a very frustrating workshop for me to deliver to you. Frustrating for a number of reasons. Number one, the lack of material available on it today and the widespread unfamiliarity with it and what it means. And frustrating, furthermore, when we realize how important these exercises were in the history of education. We see in Cicero and in Quintilian, the Roman tradition of rhetoric in particular, these exercises were very much at work. If any of you rhetoric teachers are acquainted with the Rhetorica ad Herennium, a Ciceronian treatise, you see many of these exercises referenced in there. Oftentimes, though, we miss the reference when we read those ancient works because we're unacquainted with it. So we miss that there's an allusion being made here to a method of teaching. And if we were to hand our students Aristotle or Cicero or Quintilian or some such text, and we work through it, and I've seen some rhetoric texts that do just this, that are designed to work students through and try to understand what Aristotle is saying and what Cicero is saying, that doesn't make them eloquent. Reading Aristotle does not make you eloquent. There is a difference between being a rhetorical theorist and being eloquent. And Pergam Nosmata are the actual exercises, that which the student actually does in order to put the theory to practice, put on training wheels, so to speak. In fact, Pergam Nosmata, as we'll see, are training wheels, and they're training wheels in many ways. One way is their simplicity. The exercises do have an impressive history. They were so widely and uniformly taught in the ancient Mediterranean world that they became practically standardized by the end of the Classical Age. And in a standardized form, they were forwarded into the Middle Ages, and they continued to be employed in schools throughout the Middle Ages, particularly in the Eastern, the medieval Byzantium world, a little bit more than in the West, where a lot of things went goofy anyways. But allusions to the exercises, as I said, are found in early orators. The earliest surviving handbook on Pergam Nosmata comes from the first century, a fellow named Theon of Alexandria. And the later handbooks by Hermogenes from the second century and by Aphthonius of Antioch in the late fourth century survive today. Three complete handbooks, or texts, as we might call them, on Pergam Nosmata. And these are, again, methods of teaching. It was Hermogenes and Aphthonius who were used widely in the Middle Ages then. These are late antique texts. But they dominated medieval primary education clear through the era that we call Renaissance and Reformation. A Latin version of Hermogenes' Pergam Nosmata, translated by Priscan the grammarian, in about 500 A.D.,
Hermogenes wrote in Greek, but he was translated into Latin around 500 AD. It was this Latin translation of Hermogenes that enjoyed uninterrupted and almost universal use through the Middle Ages in places of learning. It was repeatedly commented on by scholars, continuing into the 16th century when we see the printing press or movable type being developed. The Progymnasmata of Aphthonius surpassed Hermogenes' text as being the most widely used. Aphthonius' work was probably regarded as more useful because he had some concrete illustrations for the exercises. Aphthonius' Progymnasmata was explicitly prescribed in statutes of various grammar schools in the period. This is in the Renaissance period now. It was the first one put into print. Reprintings of Aphthonius' text were continuous for many, many decades in the 16th and into the 17th centuries. One adaptation of Aphthonius in Latin by a professor of rhetoric at Marburg became by far the most widespread. Beginning with its first printing in Marburg in 1542, and for about 150 years from then on, Lorick's edition of Aphthonius was reprinted literally all throughout Western Europe. We see printers from Frankfurt, Cologne, Lyon, Paris, Rome, Geneva, London, Cambridge, Amsterdam, and Venice. Printing presses from the 15 and 1600s reprinting Aphthonius for use in schools. It was Lorick's version of Aphthonius that fed the Renaissance and Reformation hunger for teaching practical eloquence. Many literary scholars who study Philip Sidney, even as late as John Milton, and especially John Milton, have gone to Progymnasmata exercises to see the building blocks for what make up Paradise Lost, for example. You can see that these greats were trained by way of Progymnasmata exercises, and you can see the presence of the exercises coming into full flower in some of their works. Paradise Lost is has been most prominent in that. It's been in the last couple of decades, actually literary scholars who are studying Sidney and Milton and several others from the age that have awakened a scholarly interest in Progymnasmata. But my interest is not just to study Sidney and Milton, although we should do that, and this is at the real advanced academic level where these texts are being deconstructed and whatnot, but we want students to be eloquent. And these exercises were used for 1,500 years. Perhaps there's something there that we need to look back at. And indeed there is, and I hope to sell you on precisely that notion today. And what I want to do is describe the exercises and show you how they work. I want to get right to the exercises themselves, and I hope through a description of them you'll see what they are and how they're used. So I'll just leave my definition of Progymnasmata as simple as elementary exercises in eloquence, let their value and their use, and let the definition sort of flesh out by example and illustration. So I'd like to turn straight to them and how the exercises work. But I began with saying that this is a frustrating workshop to deliver. Something that was in regular, constant, uninterrupted use for 1,500 years in education. And hardly anyone is aware of it. It's very, very sad. There have been some recent efforts that are at reviving it. Some of you are familiar with a text by Frank D'Angelo on composition that's designed for college composition, 100-level composition that uses some Progymnasmata exercises. And it's a good text. I don't think he quite taps into the fullness of what can be explored there, but it's a good text and worth taking a look at. What you see there before you then, and I'm going to spend the rest of my time just talking about these exercises, are 14 exercises. They are sequential. The idea is that we move from simple to more difficult or more challenging. And the later exercises depend upon the earlier ones. The earlier ones are prerequisite to the later ones. These are building blocks. Building blocks. The exercises, I think, that you will see are very, very flexible. We might ask about age appropriateness. In a scaled-down form, many of these exercises, early exercises, are easily adaptable to elementary school level. But even the first exercise there, the myth or the fable, is very useful at the college level. You can present them. They're adaptable. And this is part of their genius, I think. They're adaptable to just about any level, whichever teacher is delivering them. And again, to exhibit what I mean by that, I'd like to dive right in to the myth or fable. And here's how I'll show you how the exercise works. Let's see, I've got cords running around here. This is dangerous. And just having me up front is dangerous enough. But it gets particularly grim when I'm dancing over cords. All right, this is a fable from Aesop. The ant and the tree cricket. Let's see. Can I have it back here? Okay. And I'd like you all to get ready to start writing, because we're going to engage in a little prognosmata here. It was the middle of summer, and the tree crickets were chirping away in tuneful song, but it was the lot of the ants to work and gather the harvest, so that they might thence be able to supply themselves during the winter. When winter came, the ants subsisted on these stores. Their lot was one of enjoyment brought to fulfillment, but joy ended in want for the tree crickets. So it is that youthful folly, which has not been prone to work, fares ill in its old age. There it is. It's a fable. But what do we do with this? Well, we can do a host of things with it. Hermogenes suggests, having read this in Greek, that you render it into Latin. The key is the rewrite. The rewrite. And at this point, I'd like to pause and make a remark. When instructors give students an assignment, a writing assignment, one of the most difficult challenges is the overwhelming array of variables that the student needs to grapple with. Okay, where do I start? What do I write about? What's the topic? And not only where do I start, but then what's next? And how do I conclude? And how do I get from start to finish? And what does finish mean for me in the first place? You know, what's the topic? And so if you have a student write something, they need to worry about tons and tons of things. When you provide something already written and then give an assignment in connection with that, then you have removed one of the chief variables that a student needs to worry about. What's the topic? Oh, that's provided. What's the story? You know, how does the topic play out? Oh, that's provided. And so then you can use it to focus the student's attention on particulars. And how this exercise would work, I told you we're going to get into this here. We're going to do them. We're going to be doing an exercise in a moment. Not this one, but I'll tell you what I would have you do if we actually did this exercise. I would divide the room up into, let's say, four groups. In two halves, first of all, and then I would subdivide the two halves in furthers to make four groups. The first half, or one half, I would say, rewrite this, but rewrite this in the first-person voice from the ant's perspective. To the other group, I would say, rewrite this in the first-person's voice, but from the tree cricket's perspective. And there's the assignment. Now, I said I'd subdivide it, and then I'd subdivide the ants and the tree crickets, and you'll notice here that the moral is at the very end. I'd say, now, half of the ants and half of the tree cricket writers, I'd like you to keep the moral at the end, but the other half, I'd like you to begin the passage with the moral, to rearrange it. So, in other words, we've got four groups. We've got first-person ants, moral in the outset, first-person ants, moral at the conclusion. Then we've got first-person tree crickets, moral at the outset, first-person tree. So what we've done is we've changed the voice and we've changed arrangement. So there, just rewrite it. And you know what? Students can do this. It would take, if we were to do it here, it would take 10 minutes. Okay, everyone, 10 minutes, rewrite it according to the according to that. And then you start reading some of these rewrites. Do you notice anything different? How is it different when you put the moral at the beginning? Which do you like better and why? And you see what that exercise prompts students to pay attention to? One of the, having done this particular one, one of the fun things that becomes readily apparent after reading several in a group is that the first person's tree cricket perspective is tragic, and it evokes pathos. The first person ant's perspective always evokes a sense of justice and rightness, and righteousness was served. The students discover that simply by having different people read the different papers. So why is this different? How are they different? What does it do to it, to the story, when you do it in the ant's perspective versus the tree cricket's perspective? And then what are the students paying attention to? They're paying attention to nuances. How do you evoke a certain emphasis, a certain style? You know, how is it different to have the moral at the end versus the beginning? And why? You can have an intelligent discussion about these nuances because they're not worried about what's the topic and what's it all about. It's very simple. It's very, very simple, but it helps to train students in eloquence. And also, you can have a fantastic discussion as to why. Why do you like it better that way versus that way? And why did that work and how did that not work? It's really fun to do this and to see the pathos of the trick. You know, one's basically a comedy and the other's a tragedy. And it comes out that way. Try it yourself. It's interesting when you do it yourself. Just write it one way yourself and the other way yourself. And I think you'll see that comes out. Most people, in my experience, prefer the moral at the end. Why is that? Discuss that. But it was good to have tried it with the moral at the beginning. But is there something different going on? So this is very simple. It's very, very easy, I think, to implement. It's an elegant in its simplicity. But this is what the ancients did to prompt people to pay attention to eloquence. Rewrites like this have been, these early exercises have been wonderfully adapted in a very tidy way in some of the materials that you'll see on Logos Materials Table, Matt Whitling's materials on writing. Really, our program Nosmata worked out with teacher helps, and they do rewrites and things just like this. Okay, the next most advanced one is the tale. The difference between the fable and the tale is that one of them has a moral and the other does not. They both narrate something, but you'll find that the tale is a little bit more difficult because the moral has an orienting quality about it. It brings things to a focus, and so the tale lacks that moral. It's just a narrative. It's just a narrative. And so that's why we might say that this one's a little bit more, you know, at a slight level, a little bit more advanced. We're focusing just on narrative now rather than some overall considerations that the fable evoked. Okay? And so we have the dramatic tale on the rose. This is in Aphthonius's text. Let anyone marveling at the beauty of the rose consider the misfortune of Aphrodite, for the goddess was in love with Adonis, but Ares, in turn, was in love with her. In other words, the goddess had the same regard for Adonis that Ares had for Aphrodite. God loved goddess, and goddess was pursuing mortal. The longing was the same, even though the species was different. The jealous Ares, however, wanted to do away with Adonis in the belief that the death of Adonis would bring about a release of his love. Consequently, Ares attacked his rival, but the goddess, learning of his action, was hurrying to the rescue. As she stumbled into the rose bush, because of her haste, she fell among the thorns and the flat of her foot was pierced.
Flowing from the wound, the blood changed the color of the rose to its familiar appearance, and the rose, though white in its origin, came to be as it now appears. Tale out of ancient mythology. You could rewrite this just as we did before. You can play with, okay, let's try it first person Aphrodite. Let's try it first person Ares. That would be interesting. One of the other ways to deal with both of these exercises I didn't introduce with the fable is to contract or to expand them. That's one of my favorite ways to handle them. This is 163 words in length. Tell a student, I want this in 400 words. Or double its length, let's say. I want it between 350 and 400 words. And so a student needs to figure out what to do. And a student can embellish. Perhaps you might want to add dialogue. Perhaps, you know, what would you do to embellish this and to make it good? A very difficult exercise is to condense it. Now, expanding and condensing is something that the ancients did with these exercises. The original is 163 words. I'd like you to render it in 80. Between 75 and 80 words. Oh, that's hard. Students will have a hard time with that. And what you tell them is, it's not, you know, they need to make decisions. Obviously some information is going to be falling through the cracks. You also want to evoke the feel of it. Don't insist, by the way, that they have to put it in their own words. If there's a turn of phrase in here that they want to retain, then by all means retain it. Don't tell them to put that in their own words. How arrogant to think that their own words are going to be somehow an improvement simply because it's their own, as though they are the center of the universe, which they're not. Don't tell them to put it in their own words. Go ahead and imitate if it's worth imitation. But boy, they need to wrestle with, okay, what is important? The contraction exercise I just love. What is important? What details can save the narrative yet fall by the way, you know, more expendable, and what are more essential? And it forces them to think through this. And it gets them thinking about a narrative and how a narrative works just by going through the exercise, both expanding and contracting. I've found in my experience that the contracting is particularly effective in my working with students. Here's one rewrite of the tale on the rose. This one was rewritten with an imperative. See what you think. From the delicate foot of fair Aphrodite, punctured by the thorn rose, did her divine blood flow forth. The wound came of her desperate love-driven haste, and stained the virgin flower, the hue we now know. Mark then, ye who seek a beloved, the rose, for as a token of love it bears the true sign of love's pain. The cream-skinned goddess disclosed her affection for the mortal Adonis, and the ruddy young man returned her love. But the goddess had already caught the eye of jealous Ares, son of Zeus. God loved goddess, and goddess loved mortal. Martial Ares plotted against his mortal rival, the god of war, ever in lust of conflict, and conflict is brother to those who love. Graceful Aphrodite rushed to intervene to save Adonis, and in her loving carelessness, she tumbled among the thorns, pricking her alabaster foot. So if you love, remember the rose and the origin of its grim redness. One of the origin of this rewrite was, and this is another thing to do with the tale, is to rearrange it. The task that was presented here was, okay, I want you to tell how it comes out at the outset, and then rewrite it, and how does the narrative differ? You know, in the original, we have the pricking of her foot, and then you've got the rose thing coming at the very end. What if you put the rose thing at the beginning? How does the feel come through? And I'll invite you to consider for yourself, you know, what is the difference? What is the difference? Do you like one or the other? Perhaps you don't necessarily like one or the other, but they're different, and one might be better suited to evoke a certain thing than another. Right, so a rewrite that's begotten by rearrangement of the details. Start at the finish and then develop the background as a flashback. So that's how these exercises work.
And again, because the students are not wrestling with what to write, what's the topic, they are really focusing on, and they learn to catch an eye for and an ear for what makes an effective narrative. So, we've talked about the first two, and I'm going to devote a lot more detail in the earlier exercises, by the way, because I think by getting a feel for the earlier exercises, you will see how the prognosmata work, and so the later ones I'm just going to give a low flyover, but I'm giving you some detail in these earlier ones. So you'll notice that on my outline, I'm not giving equal airtime to every point. That's not my design here. The next exercise is the crea. Okay. And I love the crea. And in introducing the crea, I want to make a further point about all the exercises. I had identified them as training wheels. They are, in a sense, as wooden and as confining as training wheels. And that's a virtue. Because you need to go through the training wheels in order to understand certain things and precepts before the training wheels can be put off. And you see the confining constraints of the training wheels in this next exercise. But the idea is, through use of these training wheels, students will be presented with, eventually, a repository of material to draw from in order to unpack an idea or a thought. And perhaps the effectiveness of the crea exercise, for example, but this applies to other of the prognosmata exercises, is what I would say the disastrous problem of impromptu speeches. In dealing with impromptu speeches in this day and age of self-expression. I know when I took a college-level speech class, and was presented with an impromptu assignment, and all too often, impromptu assignments sound a lot like this, even in our own classical Christian schools. You know how the routine goes. You're typically given a quote, for example, or perhaps you're given three quotes and you select one. And the only preparation time that you have is that time to stroll from the teacher's desk to the front of the room. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare is a really important writer and had insights into human character, and he wrote Hamlet and Taming of the Shrew and Midsummer Night's Dream and a lot of plays that were acted. And Kenneth Branagh did that version of Henry V, for example, that was really good. And he wrote in the 1500s during Elizabethan times. And Queen Elizabeth was a Tudor monarch, and the Church of England really came into its own during that time, and it was a lot of things were happening then. That was the Tudor period. She was the daughter of Henry VIII, and she was unmarried, and so she was the virgin queen, and so when she died, the Stuarts came in. And so, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And I know that this is true because I have a sister who, now, and in, oftentimes our objective for impromptu speaking is how far can you go and stay generally on topic without ums and uhs. What a low bar to surmount that is. Isn't that sad? Or the sum total of impromptu speaking is just to get them up in front of people and get them comfortable. And so in college speech class that I took, that off-the-cuff little thing that I just did probably would have gotten an A, which I think is pathetic. It is pathetic. The crea will be our solution then to that problem. Let's let the crea be our solution to that.
This is the first of many of the progymnosmata exercises that have a working out. Okay, it's different in format and approach than the tale and the fable. It actually gives headings that the students must work through. It orders the speech for us. And so we have the encomium, the paraphrase. You see that there are three sections. This comes from Hermogenes. Three basic sections. And then the seven heads. Encomium, paraphrase, direct proof, proof by contrast, by illustration, by example, by authority. And because you're a bright and willing and very patient group, I'd like for us to try this on for size, shall we? Just show you how it works. Okay, first of all, I need a quote. Somebody give a quotation. Quotation, yeah, in the back. Okay, from Tale of Two Cities, right? Okay, and that's do we want to go with that one? Other options for quotes? It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done. That famous scene, the guillotine scene in Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. That's cheating, because that's what the ancients used and expanded all the time. Okay, who said it? Edison? Okay. What do you want to go with? Do you want to go with Dickens or Edison? Edison has. Okay, that's fine. All right. We're reasonable here. Okay, genius. Okay, so this is our quote. A crea will be an attributed quote. And it needs to be attributed. Genius is what? What's the percentage again? 1% inspiration, 90% perspiration. Okay, very good. Now, let's work this out here. That's what we're told to do. So, encomium. We need to say something about Thomas Edison, right? If anyone knows the nature of genius, who better to consult than Thomas Edison? I don't know, how's that sound? Anyone, because this is about the nature of genius, right? Knows nature of genius, who better than Edison? Okay. What were some of his accomplishments? Okay, light bulb, phonograph. Okay, I think that's good. The encomium, all right. Paraphrase. Genius is 1% inspiration, 90% perspiration. Okay, restate it, but in a way that gets its meaning plain, not so much with the rhetorical flair that the statement itself has. So who can paraphrase it in a way that just explains it? Surely, oh, come on. What do you mean? Hard, oh, good, good. Didn't you do a fine job? Is primary ingredient in discovery. I can't write shorthand here. If I had a blackboard, then I would probably be writing this up. Okay. Now, direct proof. Give me a... Notice that there are different ways of proving it that the crea works us through. Direct, just give an explanation for why this is so. Proof by contrast, that's where you take the opposite position and then you show that the opposite position is a foolish position. Proof by illustration, you give some sort of analogy, a metaphor, word picture, something like that. Proof by example is, you know, can we find an example in history, perhaps, that displays this? And proof by authority, is there some sage that we all respect who has spoken something similar? Okay, so these are
These are the heads of proof. That's what those heads are referring to. Okay? So, direct proof. Someone give me a very brief explanation why this is so. Explain the truth of Genesis 100% inspiration, 90% perspiration. One or two sentences. Why is that so? Do you believe that's true? We find things in the last place we look. Is that a direct proof? Does that prove it? Do you think we find things in the... Okay, I'm sorry, what's that? You know, I love that. Let's use that for the contrast. Let's skip ahead. And let's recast it a little bit. Suppose you spend all your day thinking. Okay, do you see that? That's the opposite idea. So I'm going to take your idea, but I'm going to frame it in the form of a contrast. So I'm just skipping ahead here. Spend all day thinking, but do nothing. What comes of it? Okay. So we need a direct back up the direct proof. Yes. Oh, great. That's fantastic. Which heading is it? Illustration. Okay, we're skipping down again. That's fantastic. Okay. Birthday cake. I'm going to write birthday cake illustration. I like that. Okay, good. Yes. Oh, the clouds have parted and the sun has shone down upon us. A pearl of wisdom on your tongue. What was that again? Wasn't that great? I want to catch it all. Okay. Success only through diligence and hard work. Oh, great job. Okay, so we've got our contrast. Suppose we spend all our day thinking but doing nothing. What comes of it? Nothing. Okay, illustration, the birthday cake illustration. Good. By example. Example of hard worker who accomplished something genius. No, Wright brothers. Wright brothers, okay. Orville and Wilbur. What do you want to say about them? How many years did they experiment that bicycle shop? I don't know the details of them, but they experimented, they created wind tunnel, they... I don't know, help me out. Can you unpack that for me? Okay, I wrote down on my notes, Orville and Wilbur Wright, wing tunnel and lift. Excellent. Okay, by authority, is there a great sage, perhaps a biblical quotation? Oh. Oh, excellent, the Apostle Paul. Win prize. Oh, great. Run so as to win prize so that... and you gave a little exposition. Can you say that again? Okay.
thinking, but active pursuit. And then exhortation. Okay, so here we go. Genius is 1% inspiration, 90% perspiration, says Thomas Edison. Did I get that right? 90%. 99%. I'm not a math guy. Behave yourselves. Genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration, says Thomas Edison. If anyone knows the nature of genius, who better to consult than Thomas Edison, the man who, through experimentation, developed the light bulb and the phonograph and moving pictures and a host of other things, the benefits of which we enjoy today. Edison tells us that hard work is a primary ingredient in discovery, and simply thinking about something idly doesn't get us anywhere. Ideas cannot bring themselves to fruition. Success only through diligence and hard work is the substance of true genius. Suppose we spent all day thinking, but without doing anything. What comes of it? What product does it yield? A masterpiece? A product of a genius? Certainly not. When we build something even so simple, apparently simple, as a birthday cake, it needs to be conceived, it needs to be thought through and planned, all its steps of construction ordered, the colors of its decoration need to be considered, the shape that it will take. And only then, will a beautiful and festive cake suitable for the occasion result. It's as though Orville and Wilbur Wright, who had an idea, the idea of flight, as they observed birds and other things, enraptured with this idea, they didn't just stand around, but rather constructed wings and tested them and developed wind tunnels and studied the nature of lift. And through diligent pursuit, finally we have the genius advance of what took place on the beaches in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And so we are reminded of the words of the Apostle Paul, run so as to win the prize. For the ends, the ends come about not by wishful thinking, but by active pursuit. And so we should be mindful then of the words of Thomas Jefferson. I didn't write that. Thomas Edison. We should be mindful of the words of Thomas Edison and what Thomas Edison tells us about genius, and we should be fruitful. Acrea. See how that works? Now, the idea is you give students this exercise and you force them, okay, I want an encomium, I want a paraphrase, I want a direct proof, I want it in that order. Training wheels. But giving them training wheels, what you are actually doing through constant use of something like this, to draw from, and if you practice the crea, Cicero himself says, I love the crea. As an adult, as an accomplished orator, as an accomplished man in the Roman Forum and in the Roman law courts, Cicero continued to do the crea exercise, even as an adult, because he saw the value in it. And it will give you, again, those tools that you can draw from when you're in whatever occasion where rhetoric needs to be called upon. When you're in that awkward situation in the video store when several people rather than just one is choosing the movie. Or when several people rather than just one is choosing the pizza topping. How do you set forth pepperoni as the right answer? Now, in the real world, are students going to work through encomium, paraphrase, direct proof, and so forth? And by real world situations, I'm talking about the pizza ordering or perhaps more formal sorts of situations that they might run into. No, but they've got it there to draw upon. And in real world eloquence or in real world writing, you know, maybe they'll skip some, but they know what to say, and they'll know what to say, and they'll know how to discover what to say. Delightfully simple. So you start with these training wheels, and of course the purpose of training wheels is that they will be removed. It's not that they're going to follow through in lockstep all their lives this pattern, but in forcing them, forcing these training wheels upon them, they now have material to draw upon, and if they practice it, and they practice it. And you'll see what results it will yield in your impromptu speeches. It's really quite remarkable. In an impromptu speaking, where you're not, you do the kriya exercise, you can do it in writing and so forth. Give them the writing assignment. Have them deliver their kriyas out loud. Do it again. One of the nice things about the kriya is, if you're in literature class, use a quote, use that Dickens quote if you're reading Tale of Two Cities. In history, we read this in Herodotus, use that as the quote. You can see that the integration of subject matter comes to play in here. And that's also true of the narrative. You know, we had I had passed over the tale exercise, but you can have someone take a brilliant passage out of Jane Austen's Emma and reconstruct that because you're in a literature class and you're doing Jane Austen's Emma. Be flexible. The flexibility of these exercises, their adaptability to different age levels, and the profit at different age levels is wonderful. The kriya is great for fifth graders, and the kriya is great for graduate students. They all can profit from it. You and I can profit from doing the kriya. And as we, of course, as instructors, we're going to have understanding the frame of our students. Naturally, we have expectations of a fifth grader that are different for a graduate student, and that's going to be reflected in the type of feedback and correction that we give. But nonetheless, the exercise is quite suitable even for, I would say, upper elementary, certainly, on up to college, even to Cicero. Now, in explaining to you how the kriya works, and in having the fun of walking through them, as I had mentioned before, I think we can more readily, Lord willing, understand and appreciate the genius of all of these exercises. Now, let's see, I wrote that kriya down here. We move to the proverb. The kriya is an attributed quote. The proverb works much the same way. If you get one of these texts, it uses some of the same heads from the kriya, but it incorporates new ones as well. And one of the proverb is an advance because it's usually unattributed. You'll notice that we use Thomas Edison as part of the person of Thomas Edison as something to draw upon rhetorically. What if you don't have the person of Thomas Edison to draw? You just have a proverb, a maxim that's sort of out there at large. Proverb, sometimes the exercise is called maxim. And how to unpack that? That's a little bit more of a challenge. And so the exercises present heads for that. Refutation and confirmation go together, giving priority to a refutation simply because it's typically easier to take down a pre-existing claim rather than it is to construct one. So, but then there are heads of arguments connected to that. Many of those, if you're acquainted with Book 2 of Aristotle's Rhetoric, some a fortiori arguments and things like that are being used. A fortiori arguments are how much more arguments. You know, if God cares for the lilies of the field, then how much more? It's a how much more argument. So things like that show up in refutation and confirmation. The commonplace. The commonplace is, in my opinion, a very challenging exercise. It's an exercise in talking about something that everyone agrees with. Like, for example, murder is bad. Okay? Murder is bad. And then you have to speak on that. Who doesn't think that murder is bad? How are you going to unpack that? It's an exercise in amplification. It gives heads of amplification then. So do you see we have narrative already introduced. Then we have some argument already introduced, most basically in the kriya, and an argument is developed more fully in proverb, refutation, and confirmation. Then when we get to commonplace, we've got a study of amplification now. In fact, Theon says that commonplace is an incomplete speech, because it's setting forth something already agreed upon. how in the real world this might come into play is, you know, suppose that you are the prosecutor arguing for a jury, before a jury, that that this rapist needs to be put behind bars and locked up. How are you going to? No one likes rape. No one thinks highly of it. I certainly hope, God forbid that we should think otherwise. But what are you going to say then? Oh, so it's rape, and then walk away. No, we need to amplify. We want to move the jury to act upon what is known to be true. Amplification is important in eloquence. If the truth is not adorned with amplification, then we have empty and hollow, fleshless truth. Encomium is praise. Vituperation is its opposite. And the heads for working out encomium and vituperation are simply opposites of one another. Comparison is taking two ideas, two characters, two notions, and developing them and playing them off of one another. So it gets a little bit more advanced, it gets more complex, because that's what you're dealing with. So that's comparison. Plutarch's Parallel Lives are long expositions of the exercise comparison, if you're acquainted with Plutarch's Lives. Characterization is speaking in the voice of somebody into a situation. This is a great one for history class. Advise President Washington whether or not he should sign Hamilton's bank bill. And so you're going to slip into the character. You can do it in literature class too. Okay, you're going to do it in literature class. I've forgotten who is that main character in Tale of Two Cities. What was his name? Yes, Darnay. Give him advice on Darnay. You should not, plead for his life, urge him not to be misunderstood for the other character that he's replacing, or urge him to. But your character, you're getting into the situation. You see how the literature teacher can use this, the history teacher can use this. We're working on rhetorical skills even as we're working on the subject matter. They're wonderfully, gloriously integrative. And then the next three exercises: a description, vivid description, thesis, and introducing a law. These are exercises that are much more what we might be familiar with a typical composition exercise. But having drawn upon the earlier ones, now you have some tools to do it. The headings are removed now from these last three exercises because the students are expected to have learned from them, and the headings become much more basic and broad, like prove here, anticipate objection here, things like that, things that would look familiar to many of us even if you've never heard of prognosmata at all. And that's what these later exercises do. Of course, you can do them well, building on what has come before. Confirmation, I think, I want to step back and look at that. Confirmation exercise is one that I enjoy. In the ancient texts, they talk about confirming not just an idea, but a story. Is a story weird or absurd? And it's usually drawn from mythology. And I've seen a lot of teachers who look at this saying, how do I use the confirmation exercise? Well, the lore of our age isn't necessarily mythology, and it's not something that students can get into. But the exercise is very well set for confirming or refuting other popular icons. So here we have a prophet, one of our own. Confirmation exercise. This is one that I was working. I skipped out of the last session, and so I worked on a refutation. The heads are opposite of confirmation and refutation of "Imagine" by John Lennon. And many of you know the song. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. And then the refrain again. And so here's what I came up with. This took me about 30 interrupted minutes. Bear with me here. But the heads just give you something. Okay, from the opponent, I'm opposing John Lennon. So I begin with, woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. It's been a hard day's night and I've been working like a dog. Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Whoever said that dead men tell no tales? He must not have been thinking of John Lennon. Though tragically killed by an assassin's bullet, John Lennon's words continue to live. But not all influences are positive ones. Too often John Lennon took us down where he was going, down to strawberry fields where nothing is real. And that is what he has invited us to do in this song. Imagine. Exposition. No heaven, this is just an explanation of what it is. No heaven or hell. No countries, no religion, no possessions. Imagine that, John Lennon says. In a universe without heaven or hell, we will live for today rather than for an afterlife. Without countries or religions, we remove any reason to kill. And communism, the eradication of private property, will obliterate greed or hunger. John Lennon imagines a secular dream of social and political sameness. Okay, heads of proof, muddled. We must not be cold to the artistic prerogatives of a musician and commit the barbarian act of reducing a song to its lyrics or its lyrics to its dull propositions. But on the other hand, tuneful as it is, Lennon in this song does put forth assertions that connect to an argument. So while extending artistic leave for things to remain unsaid, how, we should ask, does imagination necessarily bequeath a reality? How, by joining Lennon's unspecified company of imaginers, do I make the world more as one? Unlikely. And suppose if we did get together and imagine away the afterlife, religion, countries, and possessions. Get a room full of idealists to do just this. By omitting these specified things from our vision, we will surely not create the same picture in the minds of each visionary, will we? And if we add more imagining, if we add more imaginers, aren't we likely to get, instead of more oneness, more disparity? Inconsistent. But suppose we do succeed. We do achieve Lenin's cherished oneness. Is this a happy story? Nothing to die for? No distinction between my wallet and your wallet? Between my wife and your wife? Between friend and enemy? What Lenin calls a brotherhood of man is actually a sameness of man. A grayscale reality, white noise droning on without pitch or timbre. What Lennon imagines is that beauty and ugly look the same, that good and evil are moral equivalents, and the true is no different than false, improper. But let us at least commend Mr. Lennon for his bravery. No country, no possessions? Bringing about his monochrome uniformity will require courageous convictions. What do we do with those who remain out of step with our oneness? What shall we do with the unimaginative fellow who persists in calling a house or a field his? What shall we do with that stubborn, unimaginative man of faith who is lacking in imagination so much as to place value in liturgy, creeds, catechisms, fellowship of the saints, and the precious word of God? Such a man has no place in Lennon's imagination. Preserving oneness requires their removal. Such was the philosophy of Stalin, Hitler, and Pol Pot. Inexpedient. Lenin himself acknowledges our objection. You may say I am a dreamer, he says. Yes, Mr. Lenin, and we do know that you are not the one, not the only one. But having a band of followers does not make one's doctrine true, nor does it mean that your band will play in good harmony. A multiplicity of inchoate imagined dreams is the ideological equivalent of a Yoko Ono song. Anyway, you see, working through the head, this is Progymnosmata. Thank you very much.